Warning: this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. February 16th, 1929, Beverly Hills, California. Ned Doheny, son of an oil tycoon, is visited by his personal secretary, Hugh Plunkett, at Doheny's massive and breathtaking mansion, known today as Greystone. After a few hours of conversing and drinking, two gunshots ring out through the mansion, and both men are found dead. The police were not immediately called. When they did show up, they would quickly conclude that this was a murder-suicide, case closed. Over the years, rumors and speculation have led most to believe the murder-suicide was more than meets the eye. From no fingerprints found on the gun, the bodies being moved, gossip that this was a lover's quarrel gone wrong, not to mention that both men were in the middle of a political scandal. The deaths at Greystone Mansion is a case for the ages, and anyone who may have known the truth is probably long gone. This is a study of strange. Well, welcome to the show. I'm Michael May, and joining me today is Scott Michaels of the Dearly Departed Tours. Scott, I don't know if you're even aware of this, but you actually are a little bit of like a local LA celebrity, because a lot of people have been such fans of your tours over the years. Were you aware of that? Am I incorrect in even calling you a local celebrity?
Well, I can say that people... it will come to me because I can string a sentence or two together and I know a bit about Hollywood. So mm-hmm. I have become part of the landscape in Hollywood, despite the fact that I'm no longer in it. But yeah, I've been in the dark tourism business for over 25 years and I had my own museum. So I was at the forefront of all that stuff for sure.
Mm-hmm. And is it specifically kind of like the dark side of Hollywood that intrigues you? Or is it just, are you a fan of kind of mysteries and true crime in general? Like, what got you into that?
Well, the stories I gravitate towards are people that I know a little bit about. Mm-hmm. I use the analogy like if I was walking past, say, a dead body, as you do, I wouldn't need to look. But if it was Marilyn Monroe, I'd want to look. It's sort of, I need that association, not just as a reading a story just because of the murder. I want to know more about the people behind the murder. That's always been my, but I also am interested in a whole lot of different things. I always said it was a sort of a lighthearted look at the dark side of Hollywood.
Right, right. And because of that, you've gotten involved. I know you've worked on some movies and consulted on some various projects and things. Do you want to talk a little bit about that at all, or kind of let people know where they might be able to see some of your work?
Sure. Well, probably when Mike Dorsey and I, who was a mutual friend of ours, mm-hmm. He reached out to me to make a documentary, and we put three together actually, and the most well known is called The 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter. Mm-hmm. And I've always been sort of, I hate when they say obsessed by, but I've always been very interested and studied the Tate LaBianca murders. Mm-hmm. And Mike saw that in me, and between the two of us, really, we put this thing together. And I had a tour devoted strictly to the Tate LaBianca murders called the Helter Skelter Tour. Now, that documentary got a lot of attention, and it brought me to the attention of the people who produced the TV show Aquarius that was loosely based on the mm-hmm. Tate LaBianca murders. And ultimately, Quentin Tarantino saw the documentary and hired me to consult on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with the history of the victims and the crimes themselves, although the crimes weren't, I shouldn't say that, I want to be a spoiler, but he wanted to know more about the victims and their lives.
Yes.
And I was happy to provide those details.
Yes. And I know that he strived for a lot of authenticity in sort of the locations and the characters in that movie. And it might be my favorite Tarantino movie, honestly. I really like that movie.
I can't say I was a huge Tarantino fan. I liked his movies, but this one, of course, I have a huge emotional attachment, not just because of the involvement, but because I've studied those people for so many years, and to see them come to life and be happy, and that was very moving, and it was the closest I'd ever get to time travel.
Well, thank you so much for doing this show. I thought of you because of Mike Dorsey, who has been on my show before. Everybody can listen to his Biggie Smalls episode. But he and I talked a bit about Dearly Departed, and I've listened to your podcast, the Dearly Departed podcast as well. And I was like, oh, you know, I should reach out to you if I'm doing a story that either takes place in Hollywood or LA, or someone that basically finds somebody that has some knowledge about local, you know, mysteries or murders or anything like that. And so today I am lucky to have enough to have you, because we are covering the Greystone Mansion, the murder suicide with E.L. Doheny's son, Ned. And this is it's just a strange story. And I first came across it because I used to go visit the Greystone Mansion in Beverly Hills, because it's a park nowadays, when I first moved to LA. And I would bring, whenever I had family visiting, I would take them to the Greystone Mansion just because it's beautiful. You get to walk around, you can bring some food and have a picnic and see the mansion in the grounds. And that's when I first learned of this story, which we'll dive into here in a second. It is an odd one, and it does involve a political scandal. It involves lots of rumors and conjectures nowadays. And what I think I'm going to do to start us off is give a very brief synopsis of the murder-suicide, like the night of the murder-suicide, and then go back in time and kind of fill in some historical details and the who, what, when, where, how, all those kind of questions. And the reason I'm going to do that is because as I was researching this story, there very much is a like commonly held story of what happened that night at the Greystone Mansion. And then when you research it, some of those details are actually incorrect. And listeners know that I love kind of like the common story and comparing it to something that has more detail. I don't want to say comparing it to the true story, because there still is there's a chance of some cover up in this murder suicide. So I am curious, and you've told me you know a little bit about this story. If I was to ask you, and I don't want to put you on the spot, so you don't have to do this, but if I was to say, could you explain what happened that night in 1929 on February? I can't find the date, but in 1929, could you like do a brief, hey, here's what happened, or here's what I remember of the story?
You're going to think I'm an asshole, but I can't. As a tour guide, you know, going by the place, as most of them do, well, actually most of them probably don't, but, you would point out the mansion because of the movies that were filmed there, and, mm-hmm. and they would say, you know, and in 1920, they wouldn't even say 1929, but they would say, you know, the Ned Doheny, who was the son of Doheny of the Teapot Dome scandal, was murdered by his boyfriend, Hugh Plunkett, who then turned the gun on himself. And so died in as a sort of lover spurned, I guess you would say.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's perfect. I'm glad that's even your brief synopsis. So yeah, I'll kind of fill in a couple of little holes, and then we'll start at the beginning and kind of do some history, because we got to explore E.L. Doheny, Ned's father, the Teapot Dome scandal. They all kind of connect in with this in really interesting ways. So the characters of that murder-suicide, you just mentioned Ned Doheny. He was 36 at the time of this. He worked for his father, a very prolific oil man. I always kind of try to do the voice from There Will Be Blood. And his kind of people refer to the other guy, his name's Hugh Plunkett, as Ned's personal secretary. Sometimes you read that it's his chauffeur.
Chauffeur, yeah, that's the one I've heard the most.
He's actually just an old friend. They had been friends since they were like teenagers. And I would call him more of just a do it everything guy. Like he worked for his friend and would just do whatever he asked, because that was his job. Kind of like today, we'd probably call it like an executive assistant, you know, somebody that's running errands and doing anything that's asked of him. And on the night of February 16th, 1929, Hugh Plunkett, the secretary, arrives at the Greystone Mansion around 9:30 p.m. He had his own key. People knew him on the property, so he was able to get through the gate. He let himself in and went into a guest room in the East Wing. He called in sort of the internal communication of some kind, whether it be like an intercom system or a phone. He calls up to Ned Doheny and says, can you come talk to me? Ned comes down to the guest room. They talk for a few hours. And around 11 p.m., Lucy, Ned's wife, hears a gunshot, and she's in the library. And she doesn't call the cops. She calls the family doctor, a guy named Dr. Fishbaugh. Dr. Fishbaugh comes. He's, you know, 30 minutes or so later. He arrives at the house.
And they head to the east wing where she heard the gunshot. And there, coming out of a door to the bedroom, is Hugh Plunkett. They see him holding a revolver. He goes back into the room, slams the door. They hear a gunshot again. They enter the room and they find Ned Doheny shot. He's on the ground like he was in a chair when he was shot, and he's toppled over. Blood is everywhere out of his head. There's a whiskey glass next to his body. And Hugh Plunkett is sort of in the doorway to the bedroom, face first. Gun is underneath him, cigarette in his left hand, which is actually burning his fingers after he got shot. And the cops don't come for like 2 or 3 hours because Lucy calls family members first. So family comes over and is tramping around the scene before cops ever show up. The cops show up and they kind of briefly just go, yeah, murder, suicide. There you go. Bada bing, bada boom. Case closed. See you guys later. And that's where a lot of rumors and speculation and conjecture and all this kind of stuff come into play, because the cops shut down the case very quickly. And we're dealing with the Doheny's, which are very rich and powerful. And this is in the midst of the Teapot Dome scandal, which, again, I'll get into in a second. But there are some rumors that these two guys were killed each other, or Hugh shot Ned or Ned shot Hugh. There's debate all around it because they were both having to testify to the Senate about the Teapot Dome scandal. So that's, again, the common story. And you even put it wisely as well. The rumor I always heard is that they were lovers, and that had something to do with what happened that night. And as I said, I actually found some more information to this story that does put some of that into doubt, and even the events of the night into doubt as well. So yeah, it's gonna be fun. I'm glad.
Why let the truth ruin a good story, Mike? Honest to God.
Right. Well, because it's still really strange. Like, it doesn't ruin the story because it really still could be any of these things. And the biggest question about this is, why did the police? I think it was 2 days later that they just closed the case. And there's evidence that the bodies were moved. There's strange things about gunpowder residue, which I'll get into, that was notated right away in the newspapers. And the cops still just closed the case super quick.
Do you know if it was, I know Beverly Hills has only been incorporated about 102 years, maybe. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess they would have had their own police department at that point, but it could have been very big because the Doheny's owned so much of Beverly Hills at that point.
They did. In fact, the mansion Greystone, the land it was built on, which today is, it's just north of Sunset Boulevard at Beverly Hills. And if people listening have not been to Beverly Hills, whatever you imagine the hills of Beverly Hills being, that is what it's like today. It's mansions and beautiful properties and movie stars and those kind of people. But at that time, that the hills in that area were owned by the Doheny's, and they used it as a ranch. They would hike there. They would ride horses. There were no houses built. Sunset Boulevard was a dirt road at that point in time in that area. And I'll give myself a little props here. If you want to know more about the history of Sunset Boulevard, watch Autobiography on Motor Trend TV with myself, as we have an episode called Dead Man's Curve, where we actually do talk about the history of Sunset Boulevard. So yeah, it was just fields and dirt and ranches. Beverly Hills was there. They did have their own police department, but it was very tiny. And most of the wealthy people in Los Angeles at the time lived kind of southwest of downtown. Brentwood, Beverly Hills, those places were not developed. They weren't, you know, they weren't what they are today. So that is that's a very good point, Scott.
I think they were just hunting off their balcony. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't doubt it.
They just were. I mean, they had so much land, it wasn't even true.
Yeah. All right. So to really understand the depths of this mystery, we do have to start with Ned Doheny's father, E.L. Edward Lawrence Doheny. He was an oil man. And it's funny that this murder takes place in the Greystone Mansion, because Doheny is a little bit of an inspiration for There Will Be Blood, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Not fully, it's loosely based on Edward Lawrence Doheny. And they even shot the bowling alley scene for that movie in the Greystone Mansion. So that's just a fun bit of Hollywood history there. So Edward Lawrence was born in Wisconsin in 1856. And when he became an adult, he was trying to prospect and mine and find his fortune throughout the Southwest of the United States, specifically Arizona and New Mexico. That's where he met his business partner, Charles Canfield. And also he met a guy named Albert Fall, who would later be involved with the Teapot Dome scandal, which we'll get to as well. E.L. Doheny moved to Los Angeles in the 1890s because his business partner had moved out first, Canfield, and E.L. kind of followed him. And in 1892, they discovered oil just north of downtown Los Angeles. And by 1900, they were making $500,000 to $1 million a year just on that oil field. But like all other good oil men, they had bought other oil fields and they were growing very quickly. He even had oil fields in a company in Mexico. And by the 1920s, his only rival was really John D. Rockefeller. So Doheny was one of the richest men in the world by the 1920s. And L.A. was his home. Like he was an L.A. guy. And he did have a daughter in 1893, but she died very young. And then he had his son, Edward Jr., or as they called Ned, that's in our story. And Ned's mother, she and E.L. actually got divorced. I think it was in the 1890s when they got divorced. But this is just a little piece of information to keep in the back of your mind. She actually committed suicide when he was still very young. She drank battery acid, which just that does not sound like a fun way to go.
No, it wasn't to be my first choice.
No, I'm glad to hear that. So there's a lot of stories and details about Edward Lawrence Doheny. For the sake of our story, it's just safe to say he's very, 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 very rich and very powerful and lusted for more money and more land and more power. And Ned, his son, was kind of his pride and joy. And like a lot of tropes about kids growing up with these super wealthy industrialist guys, Ned was a bit spoiled and was heavy into drinking, even as a young man throughout his life, and basically just worked for his dad and had it rather easy. Now, the mansion, Greystone, that we keep talking about, which I definitely recommend if you come to LA, please go visit it. It is open. You can get, not, you can't go inside the mansion unless you're there for a private event, but you can go to the grounds and it is amazing. I don't know if you had the same experience, Scott, but I kept thinking that E.L. Doheny built the mansion, but it was Ned. And I wasn't even aware of that until recently. Did you think E.L. built it?
No, I hadn't heard that. Oh, wait. No, it was built for his son for their wedding, wasn't it?
Wedding. It was a gift.
Wedding present.
Yeah. So it was a gift for the land was a gift, but E.L. didn't design the home or have it built. So Ned had it built. E.L. paid for it, obviously. but it was Ned's kind of dream to have it built. And what they did is when they first decided to build this and they get the land as a wedding gift, Ned actually hired a guy named Wallace Neff to design the home. And then for some reason, they didn't like the design. They fired him. They hired Gordon Kaufman, who designed a lot of other famous buildings and things around Southern California. And the Doheny sent people to Europe to find designs and furnishings. They even went to Europe themselves to like get inspired. And they would hire craftsmen from Europe to come to LA to build this house. And by the time it was done, they had spent around $500 million in today's money. No one knows for sure. It could have been more than that. And Ned Doheny moved in with his wife, Lucy, their five kids in late 1928. It was the second largest house in California after only the Hearst Castle in San Simeon, which is another place everybody should go visit. That's so cool. And the mansion was 46,000 square feet. So just a little bit bigger than my house, just a tad, just a very small amount. Now, while this home is being dripped up and built, a little tiny political event in U.S. history, a thing called the Teapot Dome scandal was going on, which is the biggest political scandal in the 20th century until Watergate in the 1970s. And every single one of our characters today is caught up in that scandal in one way or another. And I'm a big Downton Abbey fan. I came into it late. I actually just started watching it this year. But they even talk about the Teapot Dome scandal in one of the episodes of Downton Abbey. So that's fun. The scandal. Do you know much about the Teapot Dome scandal?
You know, I didn't retain it because
I'm
a Hollywood person and it's like,
yep. No, me neither. I mean, I kind of read about it because of this story, because I honestly couldn't remember much about it at all. So it involves President Harding's presidency and basically a lot of corruption charges, bribery charges, specifically around Harding's Secretary of the Interior, a guy named Albert Fall, who I mentioned a little earlier, was friends with E.L. Doheny. They met when they were prospectors and miners in Arizona. And Albert Fall, the gist of it is he took money to give land leases to oil guys for super cheap. They didn't compete. They didn't take other bids. He just took federal land and gave it to these oil men, including E.L. Doheny, for a place called Elks Hill, California. It was the Teapot Dome scandals named after another area that was given to a different oil tycoon called the Teapot Dome in Wyoming. Mr. Doheny gave Albert Fall $100,000 cash for the rights to the land. And the way that he paid for it, the way that he got the money to Albert Fall, is Ned Doheny, his pride and joy son and Ned's best friend slash secretary slash chauffeur, Hugh Plunkett, went to the East Coast, went to New York. They walked into a bank. They got $100,000 cash out of an account. They put it in a black briefcase or attaché case or something like that. And they took it to Albert Fall directly. And I think this is in 1921 when the payoff actually happened. So Ned and Hugh, are people from the murder-suicide, are the ones that actually handed the money over in the Teapot Dome scandal. So that's huge, huge news. And I was reading old newspaper articles about the scandal, and one of them quoted as saying that Albert Fall was paid in quote unquote new bills, which I just love that imagery of like those crisp, clean, you know, dollar bills.
And I like your, I like the attaché case. That sounds so.
That's what I really hope it was. And I hope they wore like gloves when they delivered it. I don't know. I would do it up, guys. So in 1927, the Supreme Court ruled that these leases on these lands were improper, and they took the land back and gave it to the government. And Albert Fall actually went to jail for taking these bribes. However, the rich guys that bribed Albert Fall, they didn't even get a slap on the wrist, because that's the way the world works. And however, in 1929, it was still being investigated by the Senate because politics. So politicians are trying to use it to all their different ways that politics do politicking. And they were still bringing in Hugh and Ned for questioning later on to testify more about the bribery. So Hugh Plunkett, being an employee, a lot of people assume that he might have been set up to take a fall.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've always understood. Yeah.
It's a very wise thought or theory, and I don't have an answer to any of that, but it's definitely worth keeping in the back of your minds as you hear the story. So Hugh Plunkett, again, just to kind of refresh for the night of the murder suicide, he's the one that supposedly shot Ned and then shot himself. And there's a story I came across that is actually, there's a lot more to it than I initially read, but apparently the day or two before the murder suicide, Lucy and Ned went to Hugh Plunkett's apartment and had what they were calling, or I'll call, an intervention. And they were like, you're acting weird, you're stressed, you're drinking too much, you're taking pills, you've got to get some help. You've got to go to like a sanitarium, you've got to go to a hospital, you got to calm down and get some help. And apparently
your mouth shut.
Right. And that's the secret to this, is were they doing it to say, keep your mouth shut? And, yeah, so that's going on in the background of all of this. And the family doctor, Dr. Fishbaugh, he, after the murder-suicide, he kept talking to the authorities about this, saying that Hugh was taking, I think, 10 times the recommended doses of whatever sort of pills he was taking at the time. And he also was having teeth pain and back pain and all this kind of stuff. When you look into this, though, as much as I keep wanting to go kind of down that alley of like, keep your fucking mouth shut, Hugh. Look, go to a hospital. You're going through something. Let's just get you away from this testimony. He actually was going through a divorce, and the doctor told authorities that the divorce was really having a huge impact on Hugh. So that's just something, because that's where, again, these rumors and things, there's like one side of like, oh, are the Doheny's doing all of this to make sure that they're protecting the Teapot Dome scandal? Or is Hugh actually really going through something after investigating a lot of crazy stories in my life? I kind of think there's probably truth to both of those. Like, he probably was dealing with a lot in his divorce, but he was also possibly very stressed about testifying and knowing what happened and knowing about the bribery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. I mean, I agree, but I think more so because they were throwing him under the bus and he was like, what do I do here? Here's Ned, my friend, or however their relationship is. And they were like, no, we got to get out of this. And it's like, well, you mentioned earlier, he's like the easy fall guy. Let's pin it on him.
Absolutely.
And it does make sense.
Yeah, it really does. It all kind of ties together. So, yeah, and we already mentioned this. I highlighted this in my notes because I really want to make sure to say it. But if he actually goes to a sanitarium or a hospital or something to get help, he would not have to go testify. So that definitely lines up as like there's probably some influence upon him to go get help, not just for his own mental health, but also we don't want you to testify. And so all of this is leading up just days before the murder. And now we're going to go back to the night of the murder-suicide, and I'm going to fill in details that we didn't talk about earlier. And this is all just important to kind of understand the evening. And a lot of the information I found is from reading old newspapers, which you can't fully trust. However, I did find a book called Beverly Hills Confidential, A Century of Star Scandals and Murders by Barbara Schroeder and Clark Fogg. And they actually were able to access Beverly Hills police records that no one had looked at in the 100 years of this case having been going on. And they weren't super, like, they didn't really definitively solve the case or anything, but it definitely shed some light into some activity and more witness statements from that evening. So, yeah, so here we are. So it's February 16th, 1929. It was a Saturday, and Hugh Plunkett, Ned and Lucy, and Dr. Fishball actually all had lunch together that morning or day or afternoon at the Greystone Mansion. Now, according to the doctor's witness statements, he was there because they were trying to get Hugh, like we've already said, to go somewhere to get help. And they were all discussing it because Hugh didn't want to go get help. They leave lunch, specifically the doctor and Hugh. They're leaving lunch, and on the way out, the Doheny's tell Dr. Fishbaugh, make sure we can contact you later, because Hugh's definitely going through something. So we just want to make sure like you're on call, we can page you just in case something happens. And the doctor's like, of course. So that night, around 9:30, Hugh comes back to the Greystone Mansion. And this is where our first little scene comes in, Scott. And what I'll do is I'll read the narration or the scene descriptions. And let's have you read Hugh.
Okay.
Hugh Plunkett rolls up to the gate of the Greystone Mansion in his car. It's around 9:30 p.m. He cranks his window down as the guard approaches. Evening, Mr. Plunkett. Didn't expect you back tonight.
Hi, Will.
The guard opens the gate and waves Hugh through.
Have a good one.
Moments later, Hugh is walking to the entrance of the mansion when he stumbles upon night watchman Ed McCarthy. Mr. Plunkett, hello.
Evening, Ed. I suppose they've all turned in for the night?
I don't think so. Not as far as I can tell, anyway.
I see.
Hugh nods goodnight to Ed and continues into the mansion. I find it really interesting that there were more witnesses than I ever expected, because there was the night watchman, there was the gatekeeper, also there was a live-in, like, writing instructor who lived at the mansion that heard Hugh come in with his car and go to a storage closet where he kept fishing equipment, which is an interesting comment because I wonder if that's where a gun was. And because I don't know, because I cannot find information about the gun in anything I've read, because that's a big piece of evidence there in like whose gun was it. And I cannot find anything about it being Hugh's gun or Ned's gun.
And Barbara and Clark didn't have that information in their books?
No, they did not. So it's, yeah. So if anybody knows whose gun that was, write in a studyofstrange@gmail.com. I would love to find that out. Now, when Hugh went into the mansion, he turned towards the east wing where there were a couple of guest rooms. And now I have a question for you, Scott, because you've been inside these rooms. The stories talk about him closing the door to the bedroom, but he was found in the hallway in front of the bedroom, sort of in between the bedroom door and the hallway. So I think there's a door in the hall. Like, I think when they talk about him closing the door, it was a door from the hallway into like the main area of the house. Do you remember the, I guess,
well,
the setup?
The room that inside the place, I mean, I didn't have a map of the house from the, you know, of an overhead view of which room was which room, but the room that is commonly referred to as the murder room is actually a really modest little tiny room. I mean, it's almost like they would say servants' quarters or something like that. It's not big. So they might have a, if I remember, they might have a little sort of sitting room in between the bathroom and the room itself. But otherwise, no, it's a very small room.
Yeah, it's not big. And what I wish, because I wish I've been to the mansion a bunch of times. I've never been inside of it. So I really want to see what the setup is, because I have seen an overhead map of the home. And it looks like there's two guest rooms across a hallway from one another. And then the main hallway goes out to like a foyer or a bigger area. So I think there's a door that blocks off that hallway to the two guest rooms. And I think that's where Hugh slammed a door.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Yeah, it's interesting. But yeah, it was not a big room. It was just a little guest room. And you can actually pull up crime scene photos online. I'll provide some links in my show notes. So yeah, so Ed enters the home and heads to that modest guest bedroom where apparently he would stay from time to time. It was kind of like his room if he's staying at the house. That Hugh, I think I said Ed a second ago, I meant Hugh. Hugh actually was in charge of the building of the Greystone Mansion. So he not only works for Ned, he knows the house intimately because he was the one overseeing the building. He knew everybody that worked there. He had his own key. He would even sign checks in Ned's name during the building of the home. So he was that close with the family. Mm-hmm. And once he's in that room, as I mentioned earlier, he contacts Ned. Ned comes down to talk to him. Ned is in slippers, a coat, his underwear, or a robe, and they start talking, and they also start drinking. There is whiskey that was found in the room and whiskey glasses. Now, where things get different from the common story, remember that Lucy apparently hears a gunshot and then calls Dr. Fishball. According to all the witness testimonies, though, when Ned was talking to Hugh, Ned called Dr. Fishbaugh. It was before a shot ever happened. He called Fishbaugh because he said, Hugh's back. He's still having issues. He doesn't want to go to the sanitarium. Can you come up here and talk to him? So the doctor left. He was actually at a movie. He leaves the movie. He's paged and contacted. He comes up to the house. He arrives around 11 p.m. And there's some inconsistencies of what I've read at this point. Some of the reports say that basically the minute before he arrives at the house, there's a gunshot. Some say the gunshot happened right as he showed up at the house, the first one. So this brings us to our second scene, which just takes some assumptions to that setup. So if you have that document open again, Scott.
I do. Give me a second. Where is it?
So it's around 11:30 p.m. and Lucy opens the front door for Dr. Fishbaugh. Doctor, thank you for coming. They're in the East Wing. Lucy and Doctor walk toward the guest rooms of the East Wing when suddenly there's a gunshot. They both freeze.
What was...
Oh, no! They both run towards the direction of the gun. They're running towards the guest rooms, and Lucy calls out as they run, Ned! Hugh! A door opens, and Hugh Plunkett emerges. He shouts at Dr. Fishbaugh and Lucy. Oh, do you mind reading Hugh here as well?
Oh, sure, okay.
Yeah.
Stay out of here. Back. Get back.
Lucy sees that Hugh is holding a revolver. Hugh, what's going on? Hugh goes back into the room and slams the door shut. The doctor and Lucy look at each other and they both slowly creep towards the door. Then, after a long moment of silence,
stay here.
The doctor approaches the door.
It's Dr. Fishbaugh. I'm coming in.
He opens the door and enters the guest room, leaving Lucy alone in the hallway. Good times, good times. Now, remember, the common story here is that the gunshot happened a solid 30 minutes or more before the doctor even came, and the doctor was called after the first shot. It does not appear that that is the case. Again, we cannot fully trust all these witness statements for reasons we will talk about in a minute, but it does seem like all the news reports and all the witness statements have the gunshot happening after Dr. Fishbaugh has been called to the house.
I ask you, Michael?
Yeah, please.
If Lucy's alone in the hallway, how can there be other witness statements?
So all the people that worked there. So the guard, the gay guy at the gate, the workers.
The gay guy.
The gay guy at the gate, which I did not mean to say. He could have been. I don't know. We have no clue. And also, I will say this. There's so many problems, which is why so many rumors and things are around this case. Most of the information the police went off of is from the family doctor. I don't even think Lucy really talked to the cops much. I think they mainly talked to people that worked at the house and the doctor, and they left everybody else alone. And the doctor might have his own motives, being the family doctor to one of the wealthiest people in the world at the time. Remember all that too. I am going to read a quote from the doctor, Dr. Fishbaugh, from one of his witness statements. So here it is. He said, "I asked Mrs. Doheny to wait and opened the door to find Plunkett sprawled on the floor in the hallway, motionless. Blood was streaming from his head. When entering the guest room chamber, the body of Mr. Doheny Jr. was found lying sprawled on the floor near the foot of the bed, still breathing, but blood flowing profusely from both sides of his head. Mr. Doheny's pulse was still faintly perceptible. He was lying on his back and froth and blood were gurgling from his mouth. In order to relieve the breathing, he was turned over on his right side by me until the blood and froth cleared out of his mouth and throat, after which he was turned back into his original position where he remained. He stopped breathing in about 30 minutes. After coming out of the guest room, I met Mrs. Doheny, who had been waiting, and told her that both were shot, that Plunkett was dead, and that Mr. Doheny was still breathing. She burst into tears and said, 'Oh, how horrible,' and rushed to the telephone to call her sister. It was decided to call Mr. and Mrs. Doheny Sr. They arrived in about 20 to 30 minutes. Upon his arrival, they notified the police." So again, they call family members. They do not call the cops. They call family members. This also backs up my thinking that I think they're correct and that the first gunshot happened after the doctor was called because Ned was still breathing. And I don't really have a reason to question that. Like, why? Like, he still died. Like, I don't really doubt that situation happened where the doctor went in and he was kind of breathing and he tried to clear him. And this is actually where one of the big misconceptions of the case happens. The doctor admitted to the police that night when the police showed up that he had moved the bodies, but only so much to check if they were alive and for him to clear Ned's like breathing passages and stuff of blood. He did not move the bodies. When you read about this, people are like, the bodies were moved. They were moved. And it's like, but how much were they moved? It turns out they were really just moved in those very kind of minor ways, still very important when you're investigating a crime scene. But they were not like dragged around the rooms or the hallways or anything. They were moved for the doctor or by the
right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know how far ahead you want to get, but it's commonly known back then, especially that, the law enforcement weren't the first people to be called. It happened with Marilyn. It happened with Lana Turner and, you know, Cheryl Crane and Johnny Stompinato. The first person you call is the attorney, or in Marilyn's case, the doctor. And Paul Byrne, MGM scandal with Louis B. Mayer is another one. You know, you call, they come and clean up the scene, and then you call law enforcement.
And also law enforcement's notoriously crooked in Los Angeles.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, especially at that time. Yeah. And yeah, this is where rumors happen, though. This is where a lot of these misconceptions of the case comes from, is those little details, like calling the doctor and not calling the police and calling the family and saying the body has been moved. And by the time the police arrived, there were relatives in the house. The bodies had been, obviously, like we said, moved, maybe not moved as much as some people like to say when they tell the story now, but the bodies had still been touched and moved. And Hugh was found with a cigarette in his left hand. It was burned all the way down and actually burned his fingers, which a lot of people point out is that's weird. If you're committing suicide, why are you smoking and holding a cigarette? The gun is commonly said that it was found under his body. It wasn't. It was found very close to his body, just sort of like on the right side of his body by his right hand. And also you read, there's this weird thing where you constantly read that Hugh Plunkett was shot in the back or the back of the head, which doesn't make sense if you're committing suicide. However, there are photographs of him at the morgue. He was shot in the temple on his right side. So,
yeah, I'm looking at the crime scene photos right now, and I can kind of see the guns just to the right of him, and also a massive amount of blood, coming from the left side of his head. Well, that's where he's lying. So, yeah,
So, and there are more. The morgue photos, I think, I've only found maybe in the book that I read. I think that's the only place I saw Hugh's morgue photo. But yeah, you can see the bullet hole in his right temple, which would match up with him shooting himself with his right hand. So evidence is not super clear. Yes, he was shot in the temple and not in the back of the head. However, powder burns were found on Ned's head. Like the gun was right up against his head. On Hugh, though, they did not find the same kind of powder burns, meaning he could have been shot from farther away. And that is a piece of evidence that they found that night that the newspapers did get a hold of right away. So that has been reported on since this case came out. However, police wrapped things up very quick. 2 days, done. Murder, suicide. That's what, you know, Mr. E.L. Doheny says. So that's what the police are going to say. And the newspapers claim that Hugh died because of, quote unquote, sudden insanity. And they talked a lot about him going through all these psychological issues that he was going through, which, again, only come from the family doctor, pretty much, and the Doheny's. There is a friend of Hugh Plunkett's that talked to a newspaper in Long Beach, who was a police detective, but not for Los Angeles, I don't believe, who did tell the police that Hugh was dealing with a lot of problems because of his divorce and his fine wife, Billy, who he missed, and he was drinking a lot. So yeah, there's just weird stuff, and I'm not sure how to actually navigate all of it, even telling it. No,
you're right. I mean, it's very complicated, and, yeah, because people are scrambling to cover up, save their own asses, but,
Yeah. And so after the murder-suicide, Ned was buried at Forest Lawn, the famous cemetery in Los Angeles, which I imagine you probably did tours there. Did you not?
Oh, we never toured cemeteries, but I go through them a lot on my own.
So yeah.
We never did that as an official thing.
Right. So yeah, Ned is buried at Forest Lawn Cemetery in this very ornate, large structure. And
it's actually an altar from Italy that the Doheny's brought in.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, and you knew that. Okay.
No, but I didn't write down what it was called, so I wasn't going to say it. So I'm glad you brought it up. and Hugh Plunkett is buried just maybe like 100 feet away. It's just kind of like slightly down the hill and obviously a not as ornate burial site. And this brings a lot of conjecture in its own right, because the Doheny's were very Catholic, super Catholic, donated tons of money to Catholic churches and causes and everything else. And the Doheny's had a family plot in a Catholic church cemetery that Ned was not buried in. He was buried at Forest Lawn. Mm. And so some people think that this points to a question of the evening, that maybe Hugh did not kill Ned and then kill himself. Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe Ned killed Hugh and then killed himself, because committing suicide, you're not supposed to be buried in a Catholic cemetery. So I do not know the answer for that. Obviously, like you said, he was buried in this, you know, amazing altar that was brought over. So maybe that's the reason he was buried there. Maybe they couldn't have put that in at the Catholic Church cemetery. But that is definitely one of the main questions that people bring up.
It is odd. I mean, I'm looking at the photograph. I took one of the Doheny grave via, you know, with Hugh Plunkett's in view. And it's about six or seven rows from the Doheny grave, or memorial, amazing sarcophagus thing. And it does seem to me that would mean they felt some sort of obligation to him, because they easily could have said, no, we don't want him anywhere near there. Forest Lawn is a big cemetery. They could have put Hugh Plunkett anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, after this as well, the newspapers obviously catch wind of this story very quickly, and they start reporting on it immediately, because E.L. Doheny is a very major character in United States, and the Teapot Dome scandal is still going on. So the name is in the news all the time. And it is very inconsistent, which all the reports are very inconsistent on this case. I was going to write down a bunch of examples, but it was like so many. I was like, I'm not going to go through all these. But it's like some people claim that they were killed in Ned's bedroom, not the guest room. Some people claim that Ned invited Hugh up to his room to stay the night so he could calm down. I think that's where a lot of the rumors and speculation that they were lovers comes from, is some of these newspaper reports that reported that right away. There's also inconsistencies about what Hugh was going through. And again, we have these stories that the doctor was called after the first shot and he was at the moon. Like, there's just so many inconsistencies of the newspaper reports that it makes a complicated situation even more complicated. I think that's my point.
Yeah. The insinuating that it was a gay thing, it spells a lot of things out, because it was on the ground floor, and I'm sure that the Doheny's were upstairs, and Ned Doheny was in his, you know, pajamas and underwear. And they were in this nondescript room, you know, just off, you know, off the main hallway. Cause I was looking at the pictures again, and it appears that Ned was killed in the main room, but there's not a hallway from the main hallway. It's like straight off the hallway. So it looks as if Hugh Plunkett's lying in the doorway of the main hallway. So it's not within the room.
Interesting. So and everybody out there, if you're interested in this, pull up the crime scene photos. They are, you know, if you're okay looking at stuff like that, because it is gory. But it is interesting to see the layout and to see that he is in his robe and his underwear. Ned is in his robe and underwear. They've been drinking, because there is whiskey in a whiskey glass next to Ned. So the rumors about the lover thing, I was trying to pinpoint where that started, because it is not in the newspaper articles of the time. And that is because newspapers didn't really report on that in the 1920s. So, you know, there might be little secret innuendos of things.
Can I point one more thing out? Sorry, Michael.
Please.
As I was going over my pictures, next to Hugh Plunkett is his mother. Now, generally, if people are going to be buying a grave at need, it's the next available spot. But clearly the Doheny's, maybe they own a lot of property. Maybe they own a lot of that property on the hill. But his mother, Plunkett's mother, died in 1931, and she is buried next to him.
Next to him.
So it would have been, there would have been a line of plots that were owned by one person.
Yeah.
And something else, it just came to mind. I think there are more Doheny's on that hilltop, not just Ned at the very top, but I think there are other Doheny relatives in the vicinity. So I think it's quite likely that Doheny's just own that whole hill and provided the graves.
So I'm gonna go a little out of order for what my notes were here. I'm going to share my own personal theory. And I've changed my mind multiple times, so if something comes up, even today, I'm happy to always change my mind about this kind of stuff. I think there was a cover-up that night. I don't think it's who shot who or why people were shot necessarily. I think I think Hugh shot Ned and then shot himself. I think he was going through a lot. I think it was a combination of divorce plus pain plus the testimony. And so I don't think the murder was covered up because the Doheny's didn't want Ned to be known as committing suicide. Because a lot of people think the Doheny's just don't want their son to sound like he killed somebody and committed suicide. I actually think it happened the way the police say it happened, which is Hugh killed him. I think the cover up just comes from the fact that the Doheny's were worried this would affect the testimony, the scandal, the bribery. I think they just wanted that to be open and shut, you know, like, this is a Hugh's crazy man. He was going through a lot. He's had emotional breakdowns and obviously doing a lot because of his divorce. So that's what happened. Yeah. Does that make sense? And what you're saying about the graves is the reason I wanted to bring this up, because like, if there's other Doheny's there, that means there's no big conspiracy around Ned committing suicide. Does that make sense?
I suppose so. I cannot fathom that the Doheny's had empathy for anybody. You know, it's like, oh, if you killed my son, come here, be buried with us. It doesn't make sense to me. I feel it was some kind of obligation to them or guilt to those people to provide for them. You killed my son, here's a grave.
I see. I didn't think about it that way. That is really interesting. Do you have a theory on this at all? Has anything changed your mind about anything or given you ideas today?
I personally, I'm not desperate to believe in a sexual scandal, and I wouldn't consider it a sexual scandal, but mm-hmm. I think that Ned possibly had some sort of relationship, very close, if not sexual, very, very close relationship to Hugh Plunkett. I think Hugh Plunkett was getting thrown under the bus by the Doheny's, and he was desperate because his personal life was falling apart. And probably on that night, he just like, I'm fed up. I got to talk to Ned now. And it was damage control by the Doheny's have him eradicated. And maybe that's why they feel guilt and put him there. But going through the murder suicide, I don't know. It doesn't, it makes more sense that they got rid of him and felt a little, but that's a very public way to do that too. So that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
It was being that their son was, you know, they tried to hang it on Plunkett and provided a space for him. Yeah, it's a bit, and his mother, it certainly confuses things further.
It does, but you hit upon something that I think is very clear, but it's still worth saying, which is the murder scene, even if things were moved or police influenced or all those kind of things, it was a highly emotional scene. Like, it was not, you know, it's not a setup to get rid of Plunkett or anything else. Like, there's a lot of emotion went into the events of that night, in my opinion. It doesn't seem like this is a pre-planned situation. Something came to a head that evening. And yeah. Yeah. No, I'm glad I had you on, because I actually really like everything you just said about it. So I'm just going to latch on to all of your theories from now on, Scott. So there's one more thing I want to read that I found really interesting. So Raymond Chandler, the famous author of a lot of great noir mystery books, his famous detective Philip Marlowe, talks about a case called the Cassidy case in the book The High Window. And this is a fictional account of the Doheny case. It was inspired by the Doheny case. So this is Philip Marlowe in that book. I'm going to make a point, and it's an important point. Just look at the Cassidy case. Cassidy was a very rich man, a multimillionaire. He had a grown-up son. One night, the cops were called to his home, and young Cassidy was on his back on the floor with blood all over his face and a bullet hole in the side of his head. His secretary was lying on his back in an adjoining bathroom, with his head against the second bathroom door leading to a hall, and a cigarette burned out between his fingers on his left hand, just a short, burned out stub that had scorched the skin between his fingers. A gun was lying by his right hand. He was shot in the head, not a contact wound. A lot of drinking had been done, 4 hours had elapsed since the deaths, and the family doctor had been there for three of them. Now, what did you do with the Cassidy case? Breeze, which is a detective he's talking to, says, murder and suicide during a drinking spree? The secretary went haywire and shot young Cassidy. I read it in the papers or something. Is that what you want me to say? You read it in the papers, I said, but it wasn't so. What's more, you knew it wasn't so, and the DA knew it wasn't so, and the DA's investigators were pulled off the case within a matter of hours. There was no inquest, but every crime reporter in town and every cop on every homicide detail knew it was Cassidy that did the shooting, that it was Cassidy that was crazy drunk, that it was his secretary who tried to handle him and couldn't, and at the last tried to get away from him, but wasn't quick enough. I know it's a fictional inspiration, but it's interesting that he proposes here that what would be the Ned in that story shot his friend first and then may have committed suicide after that. And that's, as much as I don't fully believe that, I wouldn't be surprised if one day we were able to piece this together and that was true, you know?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it, again, every theory makes sense, you know?
Yeah. That's the problem when all this stuff gets, not investigated well and all this, you know, craziness happens around it. It makes it really tough. Now, the Greystone Mansion, because that is a huge character in this case and just a place that I love, it is worth noting that Lucy continued to live in it. She got remarried a year later. She lived there for a very long time. Then she ended up moving in basically across the street. She had another house built in the area. And it went through a few other owners. And then the city of Beverly Hills bought it in 1965. And they opened it to the public in, I think, 1971. They opened it up as a park called Greystone. Yeah. And that's kind of it. There's so many other details of this case that I feel like I'm having to skip over. But just for the sake of trying to tell it in a slightly entertaining manner. Do you have any other questions or thoughts on this before we finish up?
I wish, you know, I'm sitting here scrambling around to in my files because I'm looking at the a map that I got from, no, it's not that one. I went through the mansion. They had a reenactment, a very loosely based reenactment of the Doheny scandal called The Manor. It was a play that they did in the house. And I saw that a couple of times too. And that was very, very trippy to be in the rooms, although they'll use all the rooms except for the one where the murder happened, because that would be disrespectful. You know, that is so typical people. But you know, it just, it's a great story. It's and what's kind of fun is that the mansion itself has been used, you know, in horror movies and things like that. So it just lends more fun to the story, and it's far enough removed that it is a fun story to theorize. But you know, it's unfortunate that these two guys, you know, ended the way they did, and it has to do with money, I'm sure. It all boils down to money.
Absolutely.
Ultimately. But, but you know, as you say, emotion, I think their relationships, be it sexual or platonic, but certainly very deep.
Absolutely. You know,
that certainly contributed to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it can't be easy to be, again, this is basically like a glorified assistant, but it's also probably your best friend. And that is a weird, weird relationship to be in, where someone has the sort of the money and business power over such a good friend or boyfriend, you know, whatever their relationship was.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't ban him from the property, you know, they waved him in and he went right in and got to the intercom or whatever. Mm-hmm. They didn't see him as a threat at that point. So that's just more fuel to the more gossipy end of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish investigators would have taken a little more time. I have so many episodes that I've done where at the end of it, I'm like, I just wish the police just spent a little more time on this.
Yeah. I mean, it was also new back then because West Hollywood wasn't incorporated yet.
No,
a no man's land of liquor, bootlegging, and then Beverly Hills, which was orange groves and lima bean fields at that point. So I think the only thing within a mile of the Beverly Hills Hotel, aside from probably Greystone, was Orange Groves, and so they were, you know, it was quite out in the woods at that point. I think it was before Pickford and Fairbanks even built Pickfair.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was a different time.
It was. And I think Pickford lived down off Wilshire at that time, if I remember correctly. Anyway, that's not important. Just me thinking of L.A. because I love L.A. Hollywood history. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for doing this. Do you want to tell people where they can find your digital tours or your podcast or anything else? You want to give any plugs?
Sure. Well, we had since COVID and we shut down the business completely. Everything that we had on display in our museum, including like the Jane Mansfield car and Mae West dentures and all sorts of fun things, everything's been put into storage until we find a new home. So we've left Los Angeles. Now I live near Palm Springs, and I completely do all my work on YouTube now. So If you look up Dearly Departed Tours on YouTube, instead of taking people around in my van and pointing cool things out, which a lot of them are now gone from LA, they slowly but surely, so many things are being wrecked and torn down. I do everything virtually. I can go all over the world and show people. So that's what I do.
Yeah. Do you know much about the Robert Blake, when he shot, was it his wife? Yeah.
Bonnie Lee Bakely. No, yeah. It wasn't his wife. Well, no, actually they were married, I think, because she was pregnant, or she had the daughter that,
That's a story. That's a story I want to know more about, mainly because where that happened is a restaurant that myself and my family go to at least once a month.
Yeah, Bonnie Lee Bakely, people were scrambling for alibis at that point. So many people wanted her gone. And she was a piece of work. She was a piece of work.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. Well, cool. I didn't mean to go on a tangent there. I like your work, and I like that you know a lot of those things. So I really appreciate you coming on and providing the information and joining me on this weird story of the Doheny murder-suicide at Greystone.
Well, thanks for asking. I will look forward to talking to you in the future. Thanks. I appreciate you asking. This has been fun to sort of stretch my tourism muscles again, as it were.
Yeah. No, it was. I love that you had files to look at. I love that you wanted to see the scenes. Yeah.
You know, there was something else that was interesting, I think, to mention about the mansion. So it was actually like a monastery for a while. There were nuns living in it.
Yeah.
And then it became the home of the American Film Institute for a while. And that's when it really went to hell. You know, the students were like carving up the banisters.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't imagine. Yeah.
Yes. So then the city got it. I don't know in what particular order, but they have to open it legally as a museum to keep it, under their, some sort of charitable foundation. So if you keep your eyes open, they do an art designer thing, at least they used to every year, where there would be a dozen designers and each designer designed a particular room, including the murder room. So there, you can get in there sometimes, and they do that loose reenactment play called The Manor. So, definitely, I would recommend checking out, signing up at their website to get updates. But that's a really interesting, story about the nuns living there, which, it makes sense because they were such a Catholic family and then ended up, just being in the city. So, and moved and used in so many cool movies. I mean,
so many movies. Yeah. It was so many. Part of me when I was researching this, I was like, I'm going to list all the cool movies. I was like, no, people can just look it up. Just know it's in a lot. You will recognize it from so many things and TV show. I think,
and the interior too, that very distinctive checkerboard hallway. I see it in so many movies.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're obviously open to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you can get married there. They do a lot of things, and it's definitely worth checking out. I need to do it more. And actually, I think I'm going to go tomorrow morning. We're recording this the week before Christmas, and I may go tomorrow morning just to film some videos and stuff with my son. And because I haven't been there in probably 4 or 5 years, I haven't visited. So I want to go back and check it out now after I've been reading all about it.
Yeah, take your map and you can probably peek in the windows of the room.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That is a very good idea. All right, well, thank you so much, Scott. I will talk to you soon.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.